Okay, so we were talking last time about crown ethers and tailored ionophores. We showed the structure of some of those. Remember, ionophore means ion carrier and was the source of the Nobel Prize in 1987. So here are the binding constants, how strongly the crown ether sticks to various alkali metal ions. They're shown here as relative constants. The constants themselves are, of course, the equilibrium constant for the M plus crown ether going to the complex. Now, there are units, of course, to such a equilibrium constant. The units are reciprocal molar, since the concentrations are in molar concentration. So the actual, not the relative, but the actual equilibrium constant for potassium is 1,150,000. And for sodium, it's only 23,000. So it's much larger. Now, what does that mean? That means that if you had half of the material complex, which would mean that the numerator is equal to M plus in the denominator, right? Because the numerator is how much is complex, M plus the denominator is how much is not complex. So if those are equal, half of it is complex. Okay? So if that's so, then the concentration of 18 crown 6 is 1 over K. Everybody with me on that? Okay, so 1 over K means 1 over 1,150,000, so less than 1 micromolar of 18 crown 6 is enough that half of the metal, the potassium, will be complexed. But a much higher concentration is necessary to complex half of sodium, 1 over 23,000. Right? Now, it's important to note that this is done in a certain solvent, in methanol. Right? Because remember, what the 18 crown 6 does is get its oxygens near to the ion to stabilize it, so the dipoles line up and stabilize. But, of course, methanol is able to do that also because it has an oxygen. So how much poorer is methanol at contributing its oxygen to stabilize potassium than crown ether is at contributing its oxygens? Well, we can compare by looking at how concentrated is the methanol in the solution. To know that, you have to know how dense methanol is, which is 0.79 grams per milliliter, and what its molecular weight is. You put these two together and you get the concentration of the solvent is 25 molar. So now, when the crown ether is 1 micromolar, right, half of the stuff is complexed. That means half of it is still got the methanol around it. Half of it has the crown ether around it. So a micromolar concentration of crown ether is as good as 25 molar of methanol. So the oxygens in the ether are very, very much better than those in methanol at holding on to potassium. Everybody see that? So it's 29 million times stronger than methanol. Now, why? We could look at the energy that's involved in forming this complex in methanol. It's favorable in terms of enthalpy by 13.4 kilocalories per mole. Right? Now, there are 6 oxygens in the crown ether that are doing this. Let's suppose there were 6 oxygens of the methanol that would have been in the same place if you didn't have the crown ether. Right? So that means something greater than 2 kilocalories per mole is the advantage for every oxygen in the crown ether compared to an oxygen of methanol. Right? So that if you do 6 of them, you've got a little greater than 12. Right, 13.4. So it's about 2 kilocalories, which doesn't sound like very much, but if you put it together with 6 of them around there, you can see that it amounts to a very strong effect. There's also entropy. Entropy can be very complicated in a case like this because there are two aspects. One is that when a single molecule of the crown ether comes up and replaces six molecules of methanol, right? Those six molecules of methanol can do their thing independently of one another. So that's a lot more entropy required that's involved in six methanols running around free than in just one the crown ether running around free. So from that point of view, you would expect the complexation to be favorable in terms of entropy, right? It creates a lot of freedom in the methanol, where you'd only have to tie down one molecule of the crown ether. Okay. However, that's not what the numbers tell you. The numbers say that it's unfavorable by at room temperature 5 kilocalories per mole, that the entropy is that much, or 10 to the 3/4 of that is about 1,000. It's about a factor of 1,000 unfavorable in terms of entropy to do this. That doesn't seem to make sense. What it must be is that the crown ether is very much tied down, that when it's free to float around in solution, it's very floppy, right? But when it's tied down in the complex, it's very rigid. So you lose a lot of various structures for the crown ether itself. If we compare this to what it is for sodium, it's 8 kilocalories per mole favorable to bond, and it's not very unfavorable in terms of entropy, right? And that's a general kind of thing that entropy. Notice these two things tend to offset one another. The enthalpy is more favorable on the top, more negative, right? The decrease in energy on binding the crown ether to potassium is much more favorable than binding it to sodium. But the entropy runs just the other way, right? The entropy is more favorable in the opposite direction. And that's very often found, and it's not so surprising, because if something can really bind tightly, then it restricts its motion a lot, right? So what you gain in strong binding, you in part lose in terms of tying down the motions. So that's a very commonly observed thing in comparing across a series of compounds. Okay, so by making the cation large, the 18 crown 6 destabilizes solid potassium permanganate. So suppose you had a salt like potassium permanganate. It has the stability of the crystal has to do with how close the ions get to one another. If you put 18 crown 6 around one of the ions and make it much bigger, the charges are separated by more. So it's not as favorable to make the crystal. So the crystal becomes less stable if you put 18 crown 6 in. And that means that it can then dissolve in hydrocarbons. And let's see how that's relevant here in this example. So suppose we have some organic solvent. We want to use it to do an oxidation. So we put in some organic substance that we want to oxidize, and we need an oxidizing agent. Can you think of an oxidizing agent that we just talked about? Potassium permanganate is a good oxidizing agent. So we'll put potassium permanganate in, and nothing happens. Why? Because potassium permanganate is not soluble in most organic solvents, right? It just sits on the bottom. It can't get to where the stuff is that needs to be oxidized. So we need to dissolve potassium permanganate. Now, one idea would be to add water, which will dissolve potassium permanganate. So we put water in, and sure enough, the potassium permanganate dissolves. Does the reaction occur now? Kevin? What? Why?
Because they're in separate
phases. Right? It's just as bad as when it was a crystal. They can't get to one another. So what might you do? Henry? Pardon me?
Stir it?
Well, if you stir it, you get much smaller phases, but it's still two phases. Now, it can be advantageous because where they might contact would be at the surface. And if you stir it and make very small particles, you have much more surface, but still they're not really intimately mixed. Yeah?
Sometimes you can add something else that'll make it go into the solution.
So you want to add something that'll make the potassium permanganate, that's much more soluble in water than the organic solvent, soluble in the organic solvent. Can you think of anything that would do that? Evan?
You could add an organic ionophore to make it.
The ionophore will carry, that's what the four means, the ion, into the organic solvent. So for example, add 18 crown 6, and now you get a little bit of the purple color in the organic solvent, and now the reaction can occur at easily at room temperature. Okay, so by making the cation large, you destabilize not only the solid, but also aqueous, because the water tends to hold on to potassium, but if you have if you make the cation much bigger, the water won't interact so well with it, so it has a better chance of going into the hydrocarbon. So, for example, in the old days when people used to use benzene as a solvent, which they don't use nowadays because it's carcinogenic, there was a lot of talk about purple benzene. Benzene wouldn't normally dissolve potassium permanganate, but you put in a little crown ether and you get purple benzene, but it doesn't have to be benzene. You can make it go into other solvents as well. And this is called phase transfer catalysis. And notice it's catalysis, that you don't need very much of the cyclic cyclic compound, the 18 crown 6. All you need is enough to get a little bit of the potassium permanganate, a little bit of the cation into the organic phase. The anion will come along, and then it can do its trick. So you don't need a molar equivalent of the 18 crown 6. In fact, you don't even need to bring the potassium into the organic solvent. You can get a similar effect by adding other salts that have big cations, like a tetravalent ammonium ion, right, which has big R groups on it. That's also big, just the way potassium surrounded by the 18 crown 6 is. So these potassium or phosphonium salts are also used in this way as phase transfer catalysts. And an advantage of that is, if you didn't have the way of getting the ions to go into the organic phase, you would have to use some solvent that will dissolve both the organic stuff and the inorganic stuff, and those things tend to be dangerous, poisonous, and rather expensive. So this is one manifestation of what's called green chemistry, to try to change the way you do reactions so that you don't use such dangerous materials. So by using these phase transfer catalysts, you don't have to use solvents like dimethyl sulfoxide, which are more insidious. Yeah.
So with the larger organic cations, then bring the anion to the organic phase.
Yeah.
And does the crown ether have a preference for the cation or the anion?
Well, I'm going to mention shortly an ionophore that's very good at binding to ammonium ion, and there are a few that bind specifically to anions. Most of them have been designed to go with cations, but you can't bring just cations into a phase because the electric charge would be so enormous that it would immediately suck the anions along. Okay, now if making a ring is good, making several rings is better at hiding the cation from interaction with a very polar solvent like water. So these things called cryptands, crypt, you know, like cryptic writing and so on, or cryptography, is to hide things. So these things are named that way because they hide cations. So you can use these things that look a lot like crown ethers. These particular ones have nitrogen at what's called the bridgehead, where several rings come together. And then these oxygens separated by CHCH2, and different numbers of them on the different bridges between the nitrogen. So there are these different compounds where you add have just one oxygen or two or three in the various bridges. And you can see that if you look at the binding constants of these with the cations of various sizes, different ones are specific for different cations. So the one with just one oxygen in one means that, let's see, L and M and N are oxygen, means oxygen 1, 1, 1. So it's one here, one there, one there. That means two oxygens here, two oxygens here, two oxygens here. So that one, you see, is very specific for binding lithium. The 2, 2, 1 is specific for sodium, the 2, 2, 2 is good for potassium, and the 3, 2, 2 is best for rubidium. This is a logarithmic scale, so a unit means a factor of 10. So it's possible then to devise specifically designed to tailor one of these ligands so it will specifically take one ion or another. Okay. And in fact, this fact was not lost on nature. So there are bacteria that generate the antibiotic nonactin. So nonactin is this cyclic compound that has ester groups and cyclic ethers, five-membered ring ethers, and then ester, ether, ester, ether, and so on. Now, if you fold the left part of this up and then fold the right part of it up, right, you get a thing that's shaped like this, right? And we see a picture of it here. So that here's an ester, here's that ester, but notice it's in folding it up, we brought the carbonyl from being pointed outside to being pointed inside. There's the carbonyl group. It's close enough that it can bond, use its unshared pair to bond to the metal ion in the middle. Okay? And then if we go up here to the top, next to the ester, there's one of these ethers, and its oxygen also can bind to that one in the middle. And now if we rotate this thing, we'll be able to see that after we go to that one, we go across, here's another ester that binds, then another five-membered ring ether that binds, then another ester that binds, then another ether that binds, and now we're back where we began. Right? So you got eight of these oxygens surrounding the cation in the middle, and it looks like the seam of a tennis ball the way this thing is, the way this ring looks when you've distorted it that way. Okay, and it turns out that this thing in methanol binds to sodium with an equilibrium constant of 512, but to potassium much more strongly. So it can make potassium soluble in organic phases much more than sodium. So often in a cell, it's important to adjust the concentration of sodium and potassium so there's a gradient between the outside and the inside of the cell, and they can't get through the membrane because of the hydrocarbon in the membrane. But this particular noxious stuff is able to make the potassium go through the membrane, so it's a deleterious to the energy flow in the cell. So that's the antibiotic nonactin. So again, it's an ionophore. Now, let's look at a very, very simple reaction in terms of the importance of solvent in ionic reactions. So suppose we want to know how easy it is to dissociate water into the proton and hydroxide. All these things are, of course, surrounded by water. Now, we can analyze this in steps by going into the gas phase. So how much energy does it take to take these other waters away from this water? What's the heat of vaporization of water? It turns out to be 6.3 kilocalories per mole. Okay, so once we put in 6.3 kilocalories per mole, now we have water in the gas phase. And now we can start using these fancy spectroscopic tricks to figure out how strong bonds are and moving electrons around. So let's look at it. First, we could dissociate the OH bond to get two radicals, OH dot and H dot, not the cation and anion, but just the two, the atom and the hydroxyl radical. And that costs 120 kilocalories per mole. That's the bond dissociation energy. But we're interested in getting H plus and OH minus. So having done that, having gotten the two radicals, we now have to take an electron from the hydrogen atom and put it on the OH. And that's going to cost a lot of energy. The electron transfer takes you up to 392 kilocalories per mole on the scale over here. So this is the sum of the amount of energy it's taken to get all the way from the start up to there. Okay, now remember we talked about last time that the interaction between charges is 332 kilocalories per mole divided by the distance in angstroms, and they could be just a little more than an angstrom apart and not be these two radicals. So if then you make them charged and have to pull them apart, you have to pay most of that energy to get them there. You already had 120, so you've got now a significant fraction of that. You're up to 392. So in the gas phase, if you started here and wanted to make H plus and OH minus, it's prohibitively high in energy, right? It's only in solution that you could hope to do that. Now let's now analyze stepwise how solution helps it out, how water helps it out. Okay, here's how prohibitive it was. The equilibrium constant in the gas phase would be 10 to the minus 3/4 times 386. That's 392 minus 63. So 10 to the minus 290, forget that. Okay, now, if we then take the OH minus and put a water molecule next to it, it'll rotate and line up so that its plus is near the OH minus, and you gain 28 kilocalories by doing that. It's stabilized by 28 kilocalories. If you put a second water on OH minus, you gain another 18 kilocalories. So not as much as the first one, but a significant amount. Now, if you put the next one and the next one and the next one, you keep getting a decreasing return. And by the time you've put lots of them on, the total amount of solvation of OH minus is 106 kilocalories per mole, most of which came in the first three or four. Okay? Because you can get ones that are not immediately in contact with the ion, but the ones out here also are a little bit favorable. Okay, but anyhow, the total is 106. Now, H plus is also capable of being stabilized by water. So we're going to do that too. How much do you think you get off for the first one when you put the first water on OH on H plus? You get an enormous amount out, because you form an actual bond, right? The unshared pair on oxygen mixes with the vacant orbital. These other things are just lining up dipoles or making hydrogen bonds, which are just interactions of dipoles with charges. But the first water that goes on a proton forms a real covalent bond. Okay, so that's 164 kilocalories per mole to put that first water on. Right, so it's enormously more than the whole set of waters around OH minus. Okay, so now we have that in the gas phase, but having that charge, notice it's not much bigger than OH minus. So we can now put waters around it the same way we could put waters around OH minus. And if you put a bunch of waters around it, you get another 100 kilocalories per mole, pretty close to the 106 you could get from OH minus. So now if you take all these things together, you were up at 392, but you've stabilized by 106 and by 164 and by another 100. And when you put all these together, you get 370. When it was 392 up above water to begin with. So now we're down to only 21 kilocalories per mole. Right? And 10 to the 3/4 of that is not 10 to the minus 290, but about 10 to the minus 15 or something like that, or 16, right? So the pKa is 15.8, right? But notice that this comes fortuitously from a very small difference between enormous numbers. If any of these other numbers had been different by 10%, right, this would have been just completely different. So it's really, in a sense, sort of accidental that water happens to be so near able to dissociate into ions in water at room temperature. So this is a recipe for disaster, usually, in terms of understanding things, when you have a bunch of enormous things contributing and you have to add them all together and look at the difference of them. But at least it works out, and fortunately for us and life in general, for water. Okay, now, so solvation can be obviously really, really important, but the hope is that if you're talking about a bunch of analogous compounds, that they're similar enough that a lot of the differences will cancel, a lot of these subtle things will cancel out, and you can make reasonably accurate predictions, or at least confident rationalizations, of things like relative acidity of related compounds in terms of molecular structure, in terms of the molecules, rather than in terms of the solvation. But as you'll see when you look at this chapter in the book and the things we're going to talk about here, you often do have to bear in mind how solvation might be different as well. Now, when pKa is numerically equal to pH, you have an interesting situation. Now, why should organic chemists bother about pH and pKa? Those were things you talked about in general chemistry, right? One reason that there will be a chapter in a book about this is because whether a molecule is ionized or not is really important for its reactivity. What its HOMO and LUMO are depend a lot on whether it's ionized. It'll also help determine its conformation, its color, its proximity to other species, its mobility, particularly when there's an electric field. And second, because the ease with which a species reacts with a proton might predict how readily it reacts with other LUMOs. So pKa is relatively easy to measure. If this will tell you how good a LUMO, how good a HOMO you have, that is its interaction with the LUMO of proton, maybe you'll be able to generalize that, and something that reacts better with a proton will also react better with other LUMOs, so that we can get some prediction of how relative reactivities will be in more typical organic reaction. So, for example, the reaction with the vacant sigma star orbital in a CX bond or a pi star orbital of a carbonyl group. So, here's the expression for Ka. And notice that the pKa, the negative log of Ka, is if we take the log of both sides, the log of H plus is pH. And so this is the log of H plus minus the log of B minus over HB. And so that's equal. So that's, if HB is half ionized, that's like what we talked about before, if this is 1 so that this is 0, then the pH is the same as the pKa. So when the pKa is the same as the pH, the stuff is half ionized. Now, of course, if you go away from that, the stuff is more or less ionized. So if you want an indicator to tell you what the pH is, you have to work pretty close to the, for most techniques, you have to work pretty close to the pH where the pKa of that indicator is. Suppose the color changes. Suppose there's an indicator whose color changes in its acid and its basic form, right? And you use some spectroscopic technique to tell how much. It's very difficult to tell when there's less than 5% or more than 95% of the stuff. Your detection gets much less sensitive. So in that middle range, that covers about 2.5 pH units, that in going from 95 to 5 ratio to 5 to 95. So if you want to span a wide pH range, you have to use a number of indicators. Take one to go from here to here, then another to go to here from here, and so on. So you bootstrap with overlapping indicators to get wide coverage. And this is related when we try to discover the factors that influence acidity over a wide range of acidity. For example, the pKa of water is 15.7. So that means at pH 15.7, the water is half protonated, or probably is half hydroxyl. right? Half H plus, half hydroxyl, right? So if you go to a pH that's that high, water isn't water anymore. Half of it is ionic, right? So you don't have water. Okay. By the same token, if you get very acidic, the acidity of H3O plus is -1.7. So if you get more acidic than that, water becomes all protonated. It's half protonated at that pH. So you can only use water as a solvent in doing these things if you're within that range. Now, of course, there are a number of interesting things that fall in that range, but in terms of organic chemistry, there are many others that fall outside the range, and we'll look at those in just a second. But within the range, for example, you have ammonia, which can take on a proton, or ammonium can lose a proton and act as an acid, and it's 9.2. Now, it's not as acidic. It's 11 powers of 10 less acidic than H3O plus. Why? Why is it so much easier to lose its proton? Why is the unshared pair of nitrogen not as good at holding on to a proton as the unshared? Why is the unshared pair of nitrogen so much better at holding on to the proton than the unshared pair of oxygen? You know this. Yeah, Derek? Yeah, the oxygen's much lower in energy, so there's not as good energy match. Okay, so we've seen this a lot last semester. Okay, now FH, the hydrofluoric acid, is 3.2. Why is it... Why is FH so much more acidic than HOH? It's the same deal, right? The electrons on fluorine are not as able to, or on fluoride aren't as high in energy as those on hydroxide. Now, here's a H2S. Does the same story apply there? No, H2S. Is a much stronger acid than H2O, even though the S is not as high in even though the HS anion, the sulfur is not as good a place to put a charge. The difference here has to do with how strong the bond is. That is what the overlap is. Sulfur in the second row is not nearly as good at bonding to hydrogen. It doesn't overlap as well as oxygen. If the anions had the same stability, right, and the only difference were due in bond to the bond dissociation energy, that difference is, what is it? It's 28 kilocalories, right? Yeah, 28 kilocalories difference in the bond dissociation energy, right? So 3/4 of that is 10 to the 21. If the anions were of similar stability, this would be 21, a difference of pKa of 21 compared to that. It would be minus 5. It would be way down here. But it's not as good an anion. So that takes it back up again. So the reason, did I do that right, or did I do it backwards? Yeah. So the big difference here is due to the difference in bond dissociation energy. This is a slide I used last year from the book we were using then, which compares factors in the pKa for these compounds. So if you look across the bond dissociation energy for CH, NH, OH, and HF, the bonds get stronger and stronger as you go to the right. That would suggest that the strongest acid would be methane and the weakest acid would be HF. You know that's not right. It's not the bond strength that's dominating. It's the increasing acidity in the other direction is due to increased electron affinity, better anion stability for fluoride as opposed to CH3-. But if we look down at the halides against one another, you can see that the increasing acidity goes down as you would expect for the bond dissociation energy. So although F minus is the most best place to put an electron, it's not the most acidic of the hydrogen halides. It's +3.2, whereas chlorine, bromine, and iodine, those acids go for -3, -5, and in fact the most acidic is HI -9, and that's simply because the overlap is so much better with fluorine, and we just saw the same thing in the case of sulfur. Okay, now there are lots and lots of tables of pKa values, and we want to understand them in order to be able to try to generalize the reactivity with a proton to reactivity with other low LUMOs. So we saw these. Let's look at it, see what we can learn from the values of other pKa's. So this acetic acid is called an acid because for an OH, as compared to water up here, it's much more acidic. It's 11 powers of 10 more acidic, right? Why? We talked about this last semester already. What's good about ionizing in this case, losing a proton? Henry? Can't hear. You get resonance stabilization. Okay, good. Now, if we go to the chloro acetic acid, it's another 2 powers of 10 better. How can you explain that? What do you learn from it? What other factor is important besides resonance in stabilizing the dissociation of the acid? Derek?
Chlorine created a dipole across the
molecule. Right, so there's a dipole, the positive negative, right? Puts positive here, so if the proton goes away and you have an anion here, that's sort of internally solvated or stabilized. So that's good. That's called a through space interaction. Right, but there's another possibility, which is that the chlorine making that dipole required pulling electrons away from this carbon, which means that carbon is a better place now to put electrons since it doesn't have so many. So it can take electrons from here. That can take electrons from the oxygen. Right, take electrons from the hydrogen. It's easier for the hydrogen to go away. That's called an inductive effect. So you have a field effect, just that you're lining up the dipole, but also an inductive effect which goes through the bonds. Right? Now, of course, this single measurement doesn't tell you which of those mechanisms operates more. You just see that one or the other, or probably both, are operating. Let's see what it was. Oh, now, when you know that that's true, that you have these inductive effects, then you can see that there was another reason that the carboxylate group was good, that it was good to ionize carboxylic acid. Even if there had been no resonance stabilization, no mixing of the unshared pair on oxygen with the pi star, even if that had not been true, this would have been more acidic than water, because this thing is pulling electrons away from this carbon, which then pulls electrons away from here. So it's better than other alcohols, right, in terms of stabilizing, for the same reason that chlorine is. So both factors contribute to making a carboxylic acid acidic. It used to be said in courses like this that it was only the resonance stabilization that was important. But in fact, Professor Weiberg, who talked to you, did a lot of work on this and showed that the inductive effect is also very important, which in a sense isn't very surprising, but people hadn't focused on it so much. Okay. Now, if you look at an amino acid like alanine here, you can see that it has just about the same pKa as chloroacetic acid. Now, nitrogen isn't as electronegative as chlorine, but nitrogen plus is very good, right? And turns out you learn here to be about the same as chlorine in terms of its effect on the carboxylic acid. Okay, or look at this hydrogen here. Now here's a CH bond, and we'll see on a subsequent slide the CH bonds aren't very acidic at all. But this one is pretty acidic. It's as acidic as ammonium. Why? What makes that one easy to come off as H plus? Sonny? Right, you get a lot of stabilization of the charge that's left behind, the high HOMO, by a vacant orbital pi star both here and here. So this is very well set up, and you can easily imagine that if only one of them existed, if it was a ketone, it wouldn't be nearly this acidic. It's up in the 20s. Okay. Furthermore, you have the same effect we talked about in the carboxylic acid, that there's an inductive effect too, that the oxygens pull electrons away from this carbon, which pulls electrons away from this carbon, which helps stabilize the anion. Okay, now, yeah, I think you've seen these kind of things already in high school. This is alanine, which we just talked about, and I just put this in to underline how these things are determined. You add a certain amount of OH minus and see what the pH is with an electrode, and what you see is that as you start adding OH, the pH changes a lot, and then it stops changing. Because the OH you're adding isn't increasing its concentration in solution. All it's doing is pulling the proton away from the carboxylate here to make this anion. That's the pKa we just talked about, around 2.9, right? And when the stuff is half ionized, the pH is the same as the pK. Right, and then you get the second one up here when you pull the proton away from the nitrogen. So here, let's look. Now notice we're in the high pKa, very, very strong bases. So water, remember, was here. Beyond here is terra incognita as far as water goes, because you don't have water anymore. So you have to use some other solvent. And what you do is use some indicator in this region of water, see how much it's ionized, and that then tells you about the pKa. Right? And then you use that same indicator in some other solvent that's not as acidic as water, right? So it doesn't get 100% converted up in this region. Now you have the same indicator, so you hope that it's going to give you the same information here, and then you use some other indicator, and then you run out of that solvent, so you go into some other solvent that's still less basic, but bootstrap across with an indicator. And this is not exact science, so these numbers are sometimes a little bit debatable because these equilibrium constants aren't the same in different solvents for a given indicator. When you go from one solvent to the next, you assume you have the same equilibrium constant for the indicator, but that might not be true. But anyhow, you can bootstrap up and find out that ammonia is 34. And remember that ammonium, when you put a proton on here, was way down at 9 or 10. Okay, now CH, you're way out, and it's very difficult to know exactly what this is, but people often say it's something like 52. And again, I underline here that these values are approximate because you have to bootstrap. Okay, now, and we can understand these in terms of how good the energy match was in forming the corresponding bonds, right? Now, if you go to an H that's attached to a double bonded carbon, it's still, you know, not going to burn you like sulfuric acid. This is not a strong acid, but it's 8 power of 10 better than a normal alkane. Why? What's good about forming the anion when you break this H off? Or first tell me something bad about pulling this H off. Yeah. No, that's not what I would say. It's not that either. What's different in the CH bond here from here, Mike? Why?
Because the double bond.
What about the double bond? How does the double bond, the existence of the double bond, change the nature of the CH bond? Shirley? Right, it's sp squared. And we know that sp squared is a stronger bond than sp3. Right? So that would suggest that it's hard, that the bond dissociation energy is harder for this one than this one. Should be in the other direction. We see that it's easier to pull off a proton by 8 powers of 10. Right? Why? It's not the strength of the bond. It's the difference between the anions you get. right? So if you get an anion that's sp squared hybridized, it has 30% of s character, much lower energy than p, right? So you have, so this is because of the greater stability of the sp squared anion as opposed to an sp cubed anion on carbon. Okay, and here if we go to acetylene, where we have sp hybridization, it's down to 25, really far down, 19 powers of 10 lower. Not, you know, it's much closer to water than it is to the other hydrocarbons because you have sp stabilizing the anion that's left behind. And so there's sp3, sp. Notice there's no pi overlap there. And there's no pi overlap here either because the sp squared hybrid that's holding the unshared pair of the anion is perpendicular to the p orbitals that make the double bond. So it's not conjugation, it's hybridization. And here are some others where you do have conjugation, because you see, like, if you pull that H off from there, you get this one, which now does overlap with there. So these have resonance stabilization or pi star overlap. It's allylic, as we've talked before. Now, organic chemists, as I said, are very interested in pKa's for the reason we talk about, that it might predict something about ease of reacting with other things. So in Chem 206 for Harvard, this is taken from this web page here. There's a table of 6 pages of these things. And people often consult them when something comes up they want to think about. So there's lots and lots of raw data here about similar compounds like alcohols or carboxylic acids and what their pKa's are. So here's a problem for you for Wednesday. Okay? First, list the factors that help determine pKa for an acid. We've talked about a number of them here. And then choose a set of several acids. I'd say you need at least 3, maybe more. It depends on which class you choose, how many are available. But choose several acids from that table or from the text. Inside the back cover of the text, there are a bunch of pKa's. And explain what they teach about the relative importance of the factors you talked about here. What is it that makes the pKa's? And then get together with somebody else in the class and explain your conclusions here about what was taught by these numbers, about what factors are important. Explain your conclusion to some other class member and discuss together how unambiguous. Are you really sure about that? Or could it be this factor and so on, right? So see what you can learn by looking at some of these numbers. And you'll find that it's often, there's a lot of ambiguity involved in these things often. But some things can be relatively clear. And in trying to figure out what the reasons are, feel free to consult your textbook or any other textbook. The problems, often there are problems given, like here are 2 compounds ranked, or which one is more acidic and stuff like that. So that will show you what kind of factors people are looking for. Rip and Evans tables, there are references at the end where they came from. So the people that interpreted, that determined these numbers often tried to interpret them as well. And a hint, this that would be a good question for the next exam, would be to say, you know, what series did you do and what did you learn from it and how clear was what you learned? Okay, so there's a project for you. Okay, now, that's it. And now we're going to go on to see whether we can apply these ideas to studying other reactions. So we're going to look at attack on carbon, nucleophilic substitution, but that'll come next time.